verbal abuse, emotional abuse. She showed absolutely no affection towards any of them.
Numerous safeguards are established to protect vulnerable individuals, particularly children. In an ideal world, these systems work the way they're supposed to. Unfortunately, however, the child protection system is infallible, and when it fails, children are the ones left to pay the ultimate price. Anthony Avalos was born to parents Victor Avalos and Heather Barron on the 4th of May 2008. Victor hailed from Mexico, while Barron resided in the Mojave Desert in California. When Anthony was around 6 months old, his parents separated, with Victor returning to Mexico, leading to their interactions limited to video chats. In the years that followed, Barron had multiple children with different partners, resulting in a crowded living situation in their townhouse. Despite the circumstances, Anthony was known for his joyful and amicable demeanour. At school, he displayed a strong sense of compassion, always standing up for the underprivileged. His father proudly remarked, "He's a really, really brave little kid." Anthony's teacher described him as everyone's best friend and cherished the notes and drawings he made, especially for her. He had a passion for basketball, football, and the Dodgers, but his love for superheroes was unparalleled. His cousin Jasmine recalled of him.
Anthony was never a bad kid. Anthony would dress up as Spider-Man for Halloween while everybody else dressed up as vampire sandwiches. Anthony waited patiently to get a slice of cake at my birthday parties, even if it was a Justin Bieber cake. Anthony always played with me because I had no one else to play with.
At just 10 years old, Anthony already knew what he wanted to accomplish in his life. He wanted to go to college and he had dreams of joining the army, just like his uncle David, who recollected.
At 10 years old, he wanted to go to college. He wanted a future. He wanted to make his life better so he can help other people's. He is a protector of other children. He knew what he wanted to do in life. He was going to be something special.
Subsequently, Barron entered into a relationship with Karim Leyva, a man with a troublesome history. Leyva's former wife, Daisy Neva, had suffered from repeated domestic violence at his hands, prompting her to report an altercation to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Leyva was a member of the dangerous Mara Salvatrucha gang, also known as MS-13, and even displayed a prominent 13 tattoo on his forehead, signifying his affiliation. He'd served time in jail, during which he shanked another inmate. Despite his alarming background, Leyva moved into the family home. On the 20th of June 2018, at approximately midday, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department received a 911 call from Heather Barron. She reported that her 10-year-old son, Anthony Avalos, had stopped breathing.
Okay, and who needs our help today? What happened?
My son was dying with the phone and he woke up and he felt like he was fine.
Okay, listen, does he have a fever?
No, he doesn't have a fever.
Is he breathing? Okay, listen to me. Listen.
Responding promptly, paramedics and detectives rushed to the townhouse. Inside the living room, they found Anthony lying motionless. While the paramedics attended to him, Deputy Adan Ordaz spoke with Barron, who displayed an unusually indifferent demeanour despite her unconscious and breathless son. In a calm tone, she claimed that Anthony had fallen down the stairs. However, her explanation didn't align with his unconscious state. Other officers, including Deputy David Pine, joined the scene to investigate further. As Anthony was taken to hospital, the deputies remained at the home in an effort to piece together what had taken place. Heather Barron kept reiterating that she never harmed her children and expressed concerns about being taken to jail or losing custody of her other kids. There were a total of 8 children in the family, but only 2 were present at the time of the incident. When Deputy Ordaz questioned the other children, they all echoed their mother's statements, denying any form of abuse. The deputies found this unanimity peculiar and almost suspicious, as if the responses had been rehearsed. Deputy Ordaz recalled, "To me, it seemed like maybe they were told to say those things." As the questioning continued, Barron grew increasingly irritated by the deputy's presence and questioned their inquiries regarding her children. Deputy Pine remembered,
"While I was helping to save the life of Anthony, I cannot forget the mother, Heather Barron, defending herself. All I remember is Heather saying she did not do anything to Anthony, and she did not understand why we were questioning the other children in the apartment. I'm sorry, but if Anthony was my child and he was lying on the floor dying, I'd be freaking out and trying to help him. Heather at no time showed any emotion and kept blaming Anthony for all of the injuries he had."
Anthony was immediately rushed to the hospital, where doctors frantically began life-saving measures. He had stopped breathing and had no pulse, leaving the medical team perplexed initially. While there were no apparent severe injuries to Anthony's head, they noticed a purple bruise on his left ear and abrasions on his nose and cheek. To their horror, upon further examination, they discovered numerous bruises, abrasions, and even cigarette burns all over Anthony's body, from his head to his feet. He was severely malnourished, with his ribs and hip bones visibly protruding. The situation looked grim as doctors struggled to detect a pulse. Meanwhile, Barron had arrived at the hospital and was in the waiting room. Despite being permitted to be by her son's bedside, she chose to stay away. When informed that Anthony was being transferred to UCLA Mattel Children's Hospital and that his chances of survival were bleak, she began pacing and fervently claimed, "I promise I didn't do nothing.
Everybody's telling me that I'm a bad mom, that this is why the cops are keeping asking me if I'm on drugs. I don't do no drugs. I don't drink. All I do is smoke cigarettes, and that's it. And they keep on looking at me like if I hurt him and I didn't. I swear he was just acting up and he threw himself because he didn't want to eat. He didn't want to eat. That's it."
During the questioning, she was asked about significant scrapes to Anthony's knees, to which she attributed them to him playing basketball and picking at scabs. In an emotionally charged moment, Barron referred to the infamous case of Gabriel Fernandez, who had been brutally abused and tortured by his mother and her boyfriend in 2013. Barron vehemently denied any resemblance to that case, stating, "I know you guys are coming at me like I'm Gabriel's mom, and it was nothing like that. I promise I did not hurt my son. I did not let anybody hurt my son. I promise you to God you can give me a lie detector test. I did not do this." However, an investigation would be launched, and it would soon come to show that Barron and Leyva were no different than the killers of Gabriel. Barron and Leyva had a troubling history with the Department of Children and Family Services, also known as DCFS. Since 2013, a staggering 16 calls have been made to DCF and to police regarding abuse at their household. Concerned individuals, including school administrators, a teacher, a counsellor, family members and others, had reported appalling instances of mistreatment endured by Anthony and his 7 siblings. The reported abuses were horrific and included denials of food and water, sexual abuse, physical beatings and bruises, hanging Anthony upside down from the staircase, prolonged forced crouching, and confinement in small spaces without bathroom access. Some reports even suggested that the children were coerced into fighting one another and had to resort to eating from the trash due to a lack of food. The first report of abuse reached DCF in 2013, when it was revealed that Anthony, who was then only 4 years old, had been sexually abused by a grandparent. This grandparent was Barron's stepfather, and he had physically abused her while she was a minor. DCFS validated these claims, resulting in a medical examination for Anthony and a referral to support services. However, the case was closed after DCFS reported that Barron was adequately caring for her son. They believed she sought help in having the case investigated, perceiving her as a positive influence in Anthony's life, and assuming that she wanted the best for him. If they had have done a thorough background check, they would have found that the grandfather had physically abused Baron as well. Moreover, DCFS didn't think to question why, since Baron knew he was a dangerous man, she had allowed Anthony to spend weekends with him. Then in May of 2014, DCFS returned to the home following a call from Maria Baron, Baron's sister-in-law. Maria reported that Leyva had physically struck Anthony and three of his siblings with various objects, including a hose. Furthermore, she revealed that Leyva subjected the children to verbal abuse and locked them in their bedrooms for extended periods without access to basic necessities. Maria and her husband David also stated that Baron had resorted to physical punishment, hitting three of her children, including Anthony, with her hand, a wire hanger, and a wooden spoon. Baron's explanation that the children caused the injuries themselves or inflicted harm on each other was met with skepticism by Maria and David, as many of the children were too young to fabricate such accounts of abuse. Therapist Wendy Wright was asked to assess the family's home while they were being seen by a social worker from DCFS. Anthony and his siblings told the social worker that Baron had struck them hard with belts. Wendy was deeply troubled by Baron's lack of affection towards her children, noting that she appeared completely emotionally detached. During one visit, Wendy witnessed Baron verbally abusing one of her sons and accusing her daughter of faking tears while harshly brushing through her tangled hair. She referred to her children as annoying and called them little shits, as well as threatened to put them in time out. Wendy shared her concerns with the DCF social worker, expressing her belief that Baron had no intention of following through with the required services and urgently needed parenting classes. However, the social worker seemed disinterested, prompting Wendy to fear that the case might be closed prematurely. Fearing for the children's safety, Wendy called the child abuse hotline to report her observations.
Verbal abuse, emotional abuse. She showed absolutely no affection towards any of them. To Raphael, she said, he's a little he's just a punk. She told Raphael, get out of my face.
After the call, social worker Shane Buckley spoke with Baron, and she confessed to using a belt on the children and disciplining them with hot sauce. Despite this admission, both Buckley and his supervisor concluded that there wasn't enough evidence to substantiate Wendy's concerns. At school, Anthony's friends noticed signs of his distress. He was frequently hungry, asking for extra snacks, but he never consumed them all. Instead, he would take some home to share with his siblings. He also confided in his friends that he wasn't allowed to play with toys at home. The school's vice principal, Gia Grew, also sensed that something was amiss with Anthony. Anthony had disclosed to her that his mother hit him with a ping pong paddle, locked him in his room for extended periods, and subjected him to the punitive act of sitting against a wall with his knees bent and arms stretched out. Another report about the family led social worker Lucine Catron to visit the home and speak with Anthony. During their conversation, Anthony disclosed that his mother disciplined him and his siblings using a paddle and a belt, and that she locked them in their bedrooms. One of the children was seen with an injury, but it was claimed that he had fallen in the shower. Despite these troubling disclosures, the social worker allowed Anthony and his siblings to remain in Baron's care after consulting with the supervisor, again citing insufficient evidence to file a case with the dependency court.
Were you alleging more neglect or alleging more physical abuse by an unknown perpetrator? Or
no.
What's our allegation, would you say? I know we have to put something.
To cover our butt?
I know. To cover.
In September of 2015, three more calls were made to DCFS, detailing reports of Baron screaming at the children and Leyva physically abusing Anthony and his siblings. Some callers alleged that the children were locked in their bedrooms and forced to defecate and urinate on the floor. Others mentioned that Baron and Leyva made the children squat for extended periods. By this stage, the family had already been subject of seven prior referrals to DCFS, raising grave concerns about their well-being. Anthony went to temporarily live with his aunt and uncle, Maria and David. And while here, he was spoken to by social worker IKEA Vernon. He told IKEA that he and his siblings were often locked in their rooms, and that they were often beaten, and that he was never going to see his mother again. Despite Anthony's comments, he was sent back to live with Baron and Leva, and then he recanted his comments. The results of the investigation were inconclusive, and IKEA said she didn't seek a warrant to remove the children from Baron's custody. After Anthony was returned to Baron and Leva, they cut off all contact with Maria and David. Baron said that it was her belief that she wanted to prevent any additional reports to DCFS or police. Since then, the only time that Maria ever saw Baron or her nieces or nephews was when she bumped into them at Walmart. However, Baron quickly ushered them away. Trouble at the home only continued, and another caller that year reported that Baron and Leva had bruised and injured one of Anthony's brother. Baron had 50-50 custody of her son Angel with his father, Carlos Garcia. One afternoon, however, Angel showed up at the home Carlos shared with his girlfriend, Roxana Pama. They noticed that there was a large gash on Angel's leg, and when they asked what had happened, he became fearful before finally admitting that Leva had caused it. He also confided in Carlos and Roxana that Leva often made him and his other siblings fight one another. Shortly after this incident, Baron decided to give Carlos full custody of Angel. She had told them that she didn't want to deal with any more accusations of Angel coming to their home with injuries. Other reports came in that Baron and Leva made the children squat for long periods. There was another call from somebody who reported that Leva slammed Anthony and one of his brothers onto the floor. They additionally reported that he locked the children in a room and then threw dirty diapers at them. He also withdrew food for up to 10 hours. This caller said that one of Anthony's brothers ate so ravenously that he regurgitated because he wasn't sure when he would get another meal. This brother, the caller said, wasn't registered at school because Baron and Leva were worried that teachers would uncover the abuse. Finally, DCF seemed to respond. They opened a voluntary family maintenance plan. They also removed Anthony from the home and sent him to live with his aunt and uncle. The family were provided with counselling from social workers, as well as counselling for medical and family preservation skills. Anthony was soon enough returned to Baron and Leva, and the abuse only continued. In April of 2016, another caller said that Leva was once more physically abusing the children and withholding food from them. The last time the DCFS visited the Avalos family was in 2016, when they received an allegation of neglect at the home. Mildred Blue had called after spotting bruises on the faces of two of Anthony's half-siblings. They told her that Baron and Leva had withheld food from them and made them fight one another. However, DCFS caseworkers found the allegations unfounded and inconclusive. Just the morning after Anthony was rushed to the hospital, he tragically succumbed to his injuries. It wasn't until his autopsy that the full extent of his injuries were revealed. He had sustained severe injuries to his brain in the form of blunt force impacts. These had ranged in age from 1 day to 3 weeks. The other layer of his brain showed extensive bleeding. According to Dr. Cho Lewin of the coroner's office, this kind of level, you have to have accumulated those kinds of repeated injuries. Anthony was also severely dehydrated, and Dr. Lewin said that this only made things worse, contributing to blood clots in his brain. It was reported that his cause of death was most likely from child abuse, with DCFS director Bobby Cagle announcing, "What we had was a severe head injury, including a brain bleed. We had bruising and scrapes all about the body. That pattern, in its totality, was not likely to be an accidental injury, but more likely to be an inflicted injury pattern." Despite Anthony's catalogue of injuries, neither Baron nor Leva were arrested. They remained free as the investigation into Anthony's brutal death got underway. However, his half-brothers and sisters were removed from the home, pending further investigation. The revelation of DCFS involvement brought back horrific memories of the murder of 8-year-old Gabriel Fernandez in 2013. Much like Anthony, numerous people had reported Gabriel's mother and her boyfriend for abuse of the boy, but their inability to act cost Gabriel his life. Now Anthony was dead, and his case almost exactly mirrored Gabriel's. In the wake of Gabriel's murder, the Office of Child Protection was established to protect the child welfare system. But Anthony's death now raised numerous questions. Los Angeles County Supervisor Catherine Barger announced that she was asking for a review of all county contacts with the family to try and figure out why he wasn't removed from Barron and Leva's care. Despite repeated complaints of abuse, she stated, "The county is suffering a senseless murder of an innocent child, allegedly at the hands of someone inside the home, while law enforcement, social workers, and family preservation workers all interacted with the family." As the investigation continued, detectives began piecing together the last few weeks of Anthony's life. He had been the victim of abuse and torture for years, but that was ramped up to an exponential level when he finished the fourth grade on the 7th of June 2018. For the next 2 weeks, Anthony was subjected to extreme abuse and torture at the hands of both Barron and Leva. According to family members, Anthony had told Barron and Leva that he liked boys and girls, which led to a stark increase in his abuse. Barron and Leva had poured hot sauce on his face and in his mouth and whipped him with a looped cord, a belt, and a vacuum hose. He had been held upside down and then dropped on his head repeatedly. Barron and Leva alternately withheld food and then force-fed him. He was so dehydrated that his kidneys had completely stopped functioning. They had also slammed him into furniture and the floor and forbid him from using the bathroom. Anthony would also be forced to kneel on the floor sometimes on grains of rice for hours on end. When he wasn't forced to kneel, he was forced to just stand. Anthony's siblings witnessed the abuse and torture, and they were even forced to participate. Leva had ordered Anthony's siblings to fight him, and they were made to keep watch over him so that he would remain standing or kneeling. Leva also frequently grabbed Anthony by the neck and held him up against the wall, only dropping him when he was unconscious. After a couple of days of repeated abuse and torture, Anthony couldn't walk. He lay unconscious on his bedroom floor for hours and was in so much pain and unable to move that he couldn't even eat. The night before the 911 call had come in from Barron, Leva had picked Anthony up by his feet and dropped him to the ground head first, between 10 to 20 times. On the 26th of June, Barron and Leva were arrested in connection with Anthony's murder. They were transported to the sheriff's station, where they were brought in to be interviewed. During Leva's interview, he stuck to the same story, claiming that Anthony had struck his head accidentally. However, he made no denials that he had abused Anthony, telling detectives that he often forced him to kneel on uncooked rice. He even admitted that he had rendered him unconscious for about 5 minutes the day before 911 was called. In the interrogation room, it was noticed by the detectives that Leva was suffering from a self-inflicted stab wound to the upper chest. It wasn't life-threatening, but he was taken to be medically cared for. Detectives announced that once he was medically cleared, he would be booked on suspicion of murder. Barron, on the other hand, staunchly denied any involvement in her son's death. She maintained, "I promise I did not hurt my son. I did not let nobody hurt my son. I swear he was just acting up and threw himself because he didn't want to eat." Mom Podcast Food Play, thanks to Babbel, I know what that means. Do you? Recently I've immersed myself in the world of French language learning with Babbel, and I wanted to share this opportunity with you. In just 3 weeks, Babbel equips you with the ability to start conversing in a new language. While the most effective method for learning a language involves immersion and living in a native-speaking country, this option isn't viable for everyone. Fortunately, Babbel offers the next best alternative. In just 3 weeks, you can acquire proficiency in a new language using Babbel. As a passionate traveler, Babbel has proven to be an invaluable tool for me. This fall, you can also embark on your own language learning adventure with Babbel. Instead of shelling out a fortune on private tutors, Babbel provides concise 10-minute sessions designed by a team of over 150 language experts. The app's courses are exceptionally convenient and have greatly enhanced my travel experiences, whether it's ordering at restaurants, arranging transportation, or just chatting with locals. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners to get you started right now. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Morbidology listeners, at babbel.com/morbidology. Get up to 55% off at babbel.com/morbidology. Spelled babbel.com/morbidology. Rules and restrictions may apply. According to Baron, Anthony had told her that he might be gay. But she claimed she told him that she would love him no matter what because he was her baby. Despite her claims of innocence, the testimony from Anthony's siblings and other witnesses to the abuse was overwhelming. On the 29th of June, both Baron and Leyva were charged with one count of murder and one count of torture. Baron was additionally charged with one count of child abuse, while Leyva was charged with assault on a child, causing death. By the 18th of July, DCFS still hadn't come forward to make any kind of statement regarding their involvement in the case. That day, protests were held in Lancaster, Palmdale, and downtown Los Angeles against them. Among those in attendance were Anthony's family, who called for an explanation as to why he was never removed from their care before it was too late. They put the blame on the abusers, and squarely at the office doors of DCFS, who they accused of allowing another child to needlessly die. They called for a criminal investigation of the social workers who were responsible for following up on the allegations of abuse. The family's attorney, Brian Claypool, stated, "This is a case of flat-out, deliberate indifference towards the life of Anthony Avalos." He said that the records showed they had massive red flags of a household that was replete with horror, a household where numerous children were abused. He stated, "We have counted 15 substantiated allegations of child abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse. Of those 15 substantiated, we have counted at least 2, possibly 3, substantiated sex abuse claims." Among the family members at the protest was Victor, Anthony's father, who had come to America from Mexico on a humanitarian visa. On the 21st of July, approximately 100 mourners gathered in the St. Junipero, Sarah Parish Church, to bid Anthony one final farewell. In a heartfelt tribute to his memory, the family requested that all attendees don superhero shirts, costumes, or capes. Overwhelmed by grief, Anthony's father, Victor, tearfully expressed, "The only thing I want right now is for my son to rest. It's a pain I can't describe, and I hope no one else goes through what I'm going through." The somber service was led by Reverend Leo Dechant, who viewed the funeral as an opportunity to celebrate Anthony's brief but impactful life. He emphasized the need for prayer, gratitude for God's mercy, and the collective responsibility to emulate the compassionate nature of Christ in the world. Addressing the mourners, he called for more efforts towards justice and enhanced protection for children, urging them to strive for positive societal change. A couple of weeks after Anthony was laid to rest, state officials announced that they would be auditing Los Angeles County's Child Welfare Agency to determine whether it adequately protected children. They referenced Anthony's comments about liking girls and boys, and said that they would be looking into whether there were adequate protections in place for LGBTQ+ youths. While the audit was underway, the Los Angeles County Office of Child Protection, also known as OCP, ultimately determined that DCFS took considerable actions to protect Anthony and his siblings. Judge Michael Nash, the report's author and executive director of OCP, was quick to dispel any similarities between Anthony's case and Gabriel's case. He said that at the time of Gabriel's murder, his family was actively being monitored by DCFS, whereas Anthony's wasn't. Judge Nash also said that despite 13 reports of abuse called in against Anthony's family from 2013 to 2016, there was nearly 2 years of radio silence between the last report and Anthony's murder. However, Supervisor Janice Hahn pointed out that this could have been a red flag worthy of a follow-up. She queried, "Did people stop calling because nothing was done? Did people quit reporting because there was no change? To me, 13 calls and then radio silence for 2 years. Was there ever a thought, do we need to check up again? Do we need to see how Anthony is doing?" The majority of the reports to the family had been marked as inconclusive or unfounded. And Supervisor Hahn asked, "Can't we find a way to be more conclusive on physical abuse allegations?" According to the report, DCFS policies were mostly followed appropriately during interactions with the family. However, it also identified some ways in which DCFS could better protect children moving forward. These included better training social workers to interview children, improving their assessment skills, and reducing caseloads. In October, Byron and Leyva pleaded not guilty to murder, torture, and a special circumstance allegation that they had intended to kill Anthony. Prosecutors also filed an additional count of child abuse against them for allegedly beating Anthony's 10-year-old brother. Prosecutors were still deciding on whether or not to seek the death penalty, and Maria and David, Anthony's aunt and uncle, said that they wouldn't mind if they were executed. David commented, "At this point, as long as she doesn't walk free, I don't care if it's life or death." As the case continued working its way through the system, Maria and David announced in January that they wanted custody of two of Anthony's siblings. DCF denied their request, but the couple fought their decision. Their attorney, Brian Claypool, said that the reason DCFS turned down their request was because they had posted a negative picture on social media that made DCFS look bad. He commented, "That's how evil and wicked this Department of Children and Family Services is." Attorney Claypool said that he was planning on filing two lawsuits, including a wrongful death complaint, and that he was also filing a petition seeking a court reversal of the DCFS decision to not grant custody to Maria and David. Maria and David had done everything to prepare for the arrival of Anthony's siblings, who remained in foster care. Maria commented, "We were always their safe haven. It's not just hurting us, it's hurting them and our own kids. Our kids are looking forward to being with their cousins, reunited. It's been years and it just broke me all over again, just to know that we're not going to be able to be with them." The state audit of DCFS was finally completed in May, and it was much more scathing than the internal review. It said that the Los Angeles DCFS allowed children to remain in unsafe and abusive situations longer than necessary by failing to complete neglect investigations accurately and on time. Auditors determined that social workers completed 72% of safety assessments on time in 2017 and 2018, and that they found several instances in which social workers prepared and submitted assessments without actually visiting the child's home. It read in part, "Even if supervisors had identified and corrected many of these issues upon review, we found that they often completed such reviews long after social workers had made decisions regarding children's safety. In one instance, a social worker made a single attempt to contact a family within 24 hours, but then made no subsequent attempts. It wasn't until 151 days later that the department decided to look for the family, found them, and removed the children from an unsafe situation." The audit also found that the department struggled to complete neglect and abuse investigations within the mandated 30-day timeframe. It additionally found that safety and risk assessments were often late and inaccurate. Some never even visited the child's home, yet wrote in their report that the home was safe. The department also failed to consistently perform required home inspections and criminal background checks before placing children with relatives. Two social workers were found to have repeatedly used nearly identical narratives to document ongoing visits for months, raising doubts whether visits had actually occurred. The report also found that the department was working to improve conditions for children in its care who identify as LGBTQ+. It found that around 20% of youths in foster care identified as LGBTQ+, but many of them reported higher rates of poor treatment compared to others in the system. In August, Los Angeles County was hit with a $50 million lawsuit from Victor, Maria, David, and six of Anthony's siblings. The lawsuit accused social workers and the county of failing to properly respond to reports of Anthony and his siblings' abuse. Among those named in the lawsuit was Hathaway Sycamore Child and Family Services, who had provided mental health services to Anthony and his siblings. They alleged that they had assigned employee Barbara Dixon to work with the family, even though she had not reported abuse in Gabriel Fernandez's case. Attorney Claypool stated, "You will see that there were so many times where these kids disclosed to DCFS how bad it was. DCFS workers actually saw these kids getting abused, and they still did nothing about it." DCFS responded to the lawsuit stating, "At any given time, the Department of Children and Family Services serves more than 34,000 families and vulnerable children in Los Angeles County with an unwavering commitment to pursue child safety every day in our communities. Our 9,000 employees do not take this commitment lightly and look to do everything possible to safeguard the children in our care. All DCFS employees are held at the highest standards to ensure that the public trust in our service is honoured and maintained." That same month, prosecutors announced that they were seeking the death penalty against Barron and Leyva. DCFS weren't the only ones to come under fire for how they handled abuse cases around the same time. In October, the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office released data which showed that from January 2018 to July 2019, the LAPD didn't investigate nearly 4,000 allegations of serious child abuse. The reports of serious child abuse were sent to law enforcement by DCFS and are limited to allegations of sexual abuse, physical abuse, severe neglect, emotional abuse, and exploitation. In 2018, they failed to investigate 10% of the 24,000-plus reports they received. In the first half of 2019, that climbed to 13%. By comparison, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department responded to child abuse reports 97% of the time during that same period. In early 2021, Anthony's family lost a round in court when a judge ruled they couldn't seek punitive damages against Hathaway Sycamore's Child and Family Services, who had provided mental health services to Anthony. They could still seek compensatory damages, however. Attorneys for Hathaway Sycamore stated that the family had made no allegations as to what Barbara Dixon allegedly witnessed or whether she suspected any abuse that wasn't already part of what DCFS already knew. The rest of the lawsuit was still making its way through court when in May, it was announced that prosecutors had dropped their bid for the death penalty against Barron and Leyva. Deputy District Attorney Jonathan Hatami criticised new District Attorney George Gaskin for a series of directives, including one that advised, "A sentence of death is never an appropriate resolution in any case." He said that the decision to drop the death penalty wasn't based on new evidence, nor was it based on new mitigation or law. The new district attorney simply opposed the death penalty. The following month, Barbara Dixon found herself in hot water when she received 4 years probation from a state licensing board. They had found that she had failed to report abuse in both Gabriel and Anthony's cases. The Board of Behavioural Sciences also required that she participate in psychotherapy, law and ethics training, and coursework in child abuse assessment. Picture a scenario where you wake up one day and discover that essential benefits like Social Security, Medicare, and veterans assistance have vanished. The economy is in turmoil, and your local grocery store shelves are empty. Unfortunately, this nightmare could become a reality due to the impending debt ceiling crisis. Earlier this year, the Treasury Secretary warned that the US government could run out of funds to meet its obligations. If that ever happens, it could trigger a financial catastrophe akin to the 2008 economic meltdown. However, you can take control of your family's well-being during a crisis without relying on the government or others. The solution is straightforward. Prepare with emergency food kits from 4 Patriots. These long-lasting, delicious food options are designed to provide sustenance when you need it most. 4 Patriots survival food kits are handpicked in the USA with a shelf life of up to 25 years. They are discreetly stored in totes and offer a wide variety of tasty breakfasts, lunches, and dinners. Backed by thousands of 5-star customer reviews, these kits serve as a reliable source of sustenance, not only during natural disasters, but also in a world marked by government challenges and unforeseeable emergencies, such as economic crises, food price hikes, or supply chain disruptions. Having a backup plan for food security is more crucial than ever in today's uncertain times. Right now, you can go to 4patriots.com and use the code Morbidology to get 10% off your first purchase on anything in the store, including their emergency food supply kits designed to last up to 25 years. Just go to 4patriots.com and use the code Morbidology to get 10% off your first purchase of 4 Patriots Survival Food. That is 4patriots.com and use the code Morbidology. Shortly thereafter, Anthony's family settled with Los Angeles authorities in the lawsuit over their responsibility for his death. The amount of the settlement was not disclosed. The settlement meant that Hathaway Sycamore's Child and Family Services and DCFS were the only defendants left in the lawsuit. They were expected to go on trial, but before it began, DCFS and Anthony's family reached a settlement for $32 million. It was reached on the 4th of May, which would have been Anthony's 14th birthday. It was the largest settlement of its kind against a Department of Children and Family Services. The case was still going to proceed against Hathaway Sycamores, which was a private agency. Ultimately, however, they too settled their portion of the case for an undisclosed amount. Finally, in January of 2023, Baron and Leva's murder trial commenced. They had waived their right to a jury trial, instead opting for a bench trial. This meant that Judge Sam Oda would be serving as both the judge and the jury. On the 25th of January, the defendants shuffled into court and took their places alongside their respective defense teams. During opening statements, prosecutor Saeed Taimouri laid out the disturbing facts of the case. He said that Baron had been abusing her children for a long period of time, but said that once Leva entered the picture, things turned deadly. According to the prosecutor, Anthony was already brain dead and had been lying on the floor in the family's townhouse for at least one day, possibly more, before his mother finally called for help. He showed a photograph of Anthony in hospital where some of his injuries were on full display. Leva's defense attorney, Dan Chambers, countered that the evidence would show that there was reasonable doubt involving the murder charge against his client. While he clearly made no denial his client had inflicted the injuries on Anthony, he said the two major issues would be a lack of intent to kill and the issue of causation. He further said that Anthony's siblings, who had detailed all of the abuse to detectives, were inconsistent. He stated, "This case is a case of severe abuse. But as to Mr. Leva, it is not a murder." Baron's defense team opted out of making an opening statement at the time. Maria Barron was the first witness to testify, and she told the judge that Anthony had come to live with her on two occasions, once in 2014 and again in 2015. She said that she had offered to keep him and three of his half-siblings, but Barron refused, telling Maria that she needed to keep them to keep receiving her benefits. Her testimony was followed by testimony from David and Crystal Diagold, Barron's siblings. They said that Barron had inflicted the same type of punishment on her children that had been used against her by her mother and stepfather while growing up. They had warned their sister against inflicting the same kind of punishments they had faced as children, but Barron wouldn't listen. Both of them had repeatedly reported Barron and Leva to DCFS for abuse of Anthony and his siblings, but time and time again, nothing was done. They both testified that they had witnessed the abuse themselves, and had even been confided in by Anthony and his siblings. Crystal reported that she had provided information to a mandated reporter who notified DCFS that there were four victims of abuse by Barron, and that the one receiving the worst treatment was Anthony. This was when he was just 5 years old. Other testimony came from Priscilla Canuck, a UCLA Mattel Children's Hospital nurse. She told the judge that she had seen hundreds of sick and injured children die during her career. She said that Barron was one of the only mothers who had not been present in the hospital room as their child passed away. In the other few cases, parents were out of the area and hadn't made it in time or couldn't be present for legitimate reasons. Anthony passed away in hospital alone, as his mother sat in a nearby waiting room. None of his relatives were present, although one of his aunts had arrived in the room sometime later. She had driven 6 hours to get there, but still, she was too late and missed Anthony take his final breath. Barron refused to go into the hospital room until an hour and 15 minutes after he was pronounced dead. Photographs of Anthony in the mortuary were then presented, as doctors described the numerous injuries he had sustained. Dr. Wong said that his knee injuries were consistent with being forced to kneel on uncooked rice, and that his hip injury was consistent with being slammed or pushed in the corner of a room. He also found injuries consistent with being whipped with a cord, and that he had suffered burn marks. The most poignant moment of the trial came when Anthony's half-siblings and step-siblings testified. A young woman, identified only as Priscilla, told the court that she had watched her father, Leva, repeatedly drop Anthony on the floor. She said that when she returned to the home 2 days later, Anthony appeared to be dead. She told the judge that she had done a lot of work to try and move past what she had witnessed, and said that it was uncomfortable to see. According to Priscilla, Barron was present at the time, and she had witnessed her pouring water on Anthony's face in a manner that implied that they were not yet done with abusing Anthony, despite the fact he was already motionless on the floor. Before this, Priscilla had witnessed Anthony confined to his bedroom, and had seen Barron and Leva pour hot sauce in his mouth as punishment. She said that this was something her father had never done to her or her other sister. It was just Barron's children who were inflicted with abuse. On the day that she found Anthony seemingly deceased on the floor, Leva ordered her and her sister to pack their belongings. He then drove them and three of their half-siblings to their aunt's home in California City. They left Barron at home with Anthony and two other children, Destiny and Raphael. It was clear that Leva was trying to put distance between himself and the crime scene. Priscilla testified that she hadn't seen Anthony fall down the stairs or throw himself onto the ground, like Barron and Leva had claimed. As Priscilla was being questioned, Leva uttered a swear word. The judge turned to him and stated, "I have not made up my mind about anything, so your actions and how you react is part of the process of trial." Anthony's half-siblings, Destiny and Raphael, then detailed the catalogue of abuse that had been inflicted on them. They said that they were forced to kneel on uncooked rice, fight each other, and had to watch the others be punished. They both testified that they had seen Leva repeatedly dropping Anthony on his head, shortly before he died. All of the social workers who had seen the family also testified about their involvement. The evidence against the couple was overwhelming, and Judge Oda found them both guilty of first-degree murder and torture. He also found true the special circumstance allegation of murder involving the infliction of torture. They were also convicted of two counts of child abuse involving Anthony's half-siblings, Destiny and Raphael. In handing down the verdict, the judge said that the defendants had derived pleasure from seeing Anthony suffer. After the verdict was handed down, Anthony's family shared their displeasure that the death penalty had been taken off the table. Deputy District Attorney Hatami touched on this and said that the new District Attorney George Gaskin had even refused to meet with the family to discuss it. Barron and Leva returned to court on the 25th of April. Anthony's loved ones provided poignant victim impact statements, imploring the judge to hand down the harshest sentence possible. Dana, one of Anthony's cousins, said that because of Barron's actions, she no longer claimed her as family.
We played late into the night with the street lights out, running around, happy and laughing together. I will never get to play with him again. I will never get to hear his laugh again. I will never get to see his smile again. Heather is no longer my aunt. She is no longer our family. I barely even consider her a person now. No human being would ever do that to such a sweet boy. I wish Heather nothing but the worst. She doesn't deserve to be happy. She deserves to rot away in hell forever. I hate her, and I hope she dies in the most painful way ever. We will never forget my sweet cousin Anthony Nolan. He will live on in our hearts forever.
Another cousin, Jasmine, also directed part of her statement at Barron.
I don't love you and I don't care for you. I'm turning 16 this year and Anthony would be turning 15. Me and Anthony had an ongoing argument on who was older. He would say him because his birthday was on the 4th of May and mine's on the 20th of May. He never understood that I was born a year before him. Now I have no choice to say that I won the argument because I'm turning 16 and Anthony is still 10.
Maria also provided a statement.
All the smiles, all the laughter, all the I love you, Auntie Maria. Can I come to your house? Can I stay with you? It was always a yes. It was always a yes. Because I loved him so much. He made my world a better place.
She then turned her attention to Leva.
Kareem, you'll get what's coming to you. Nobody likes a child abuser. How can a big, strong guy beat up a 10-year-old child? It doesn't make any sense. It will never make sense. Anthony could have never done anything to receive that kind of punishment or treatment. I hope you both rot in hell. I hope that every day you regret what you did, and every time you take a bite of food, you think of how you starved your children, how you starved Anthony.
Victor, Anthony's father, also made a statement.
I feel some type of guilt by not being able to help him when he most needed me. I think about that every day. I miss him, but now I just don't get to hear him, see him how I used to see him through FaceTime or any other application. Instead, I have to go see him in the cemetery. I wish this never happened. I wish Heather would have made the right decision.
Anthony's half-brothers and sisters had also prepared statements. Destiny, who had also been the victim of abuse, tearfully read aloud her victim impact statement.
And my whole world, Anthony, I've loved. Anthony was everything to me and my family. Anthony was a ball of sunshine to everyone, and sadly, because of these two monsters, he is not here anymore. Anthony did not deserve any of the things that happened to him, nor me, and Raphael. I am a 13-year-old girl. I should not have to be here doing all this. I shouldn't be able to live a normal life. They both took away my ability to live a normal life as a normal girl. Sometimes I wish I could turn back time and speak up to anyone, but I can't.
Destiny became so overcome with emotion that the prosecutor needed to finish her statement.
You decide to choose and live, you decide to choose and live a man over us, your own children. You decide to let that horrible man into our lives, and that ruined everything. You stopped loving and protecting us, and that hurts a lot. Kareem, you came into our life and ruined everything. I don't know why you did it, but you did. You tortured us and hurt us very badly. If it wasn't for you, Anthony would still be here, and none of us would have to be here doing this. It is also because of Heather that Anthony is not here anymore. She did not do her job as a mom. She did not protect us and took part in the torture. I would have never thought in a million years that I would have wanted to call my own mother mom. To me, you are both monsters, and Heather, you are not my mother nor family.
Judge Oda addressed them both and said that Anthony was a helpless child who was dependent on his mother for basic needs. He stated, instead, Anthony was tortured and killed. He then sentenced Barron and Leva to life in prison without the possibility of parole. After the tragic death of Gabriel Fernandez in 2013, Los Angeles DCFS promised to do better in an effort to prevent a similar tragedy from happening again. Just 5 years later, Anthony Avalos was killed after years of abuse and neglect. Abuse and neglect that had been reported time and time again. DCFS's inability to intervene ultimately cost Anthony his life, highlighting the glaring flaws that still plague the system whose sole job it is to protect children. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Bex, Katie, Penny, and Camilla. Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way and helps to keep the show running. Please check it out if you'd like to support the show in exchange for bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms. Ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, and of course my undying love. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.